You ever had a point where life knocks you flat and you wonder if you'll ever get back up the same way again? Our guest today, Aaron Hale, knows that feeling better than most. He started out as a Navy cook, then switched to the Army to become an EOD tech. His job was to keep others safe from bombs. But one day in Afghanistan, one of those bombs took his sight. Years later, a disease took his hearing too. Most people would have called it the end. Aaron decided, though, that it was just a new kind of mission for him. In this episode, he's going to talk about learning to live without sight or sound, finding purpose in serving others, and why giving up was never an option. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to take a moment to raise awareness for something deeply important to our community, the Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. This organization is working to build a permanent national memorial in Washington, D.C. to honor the service members, families, and civilians who are impacted by the global war on terrorism. This memorial will serve as both a tribute to those who served and as a way to ensure that their sacrifices are recognized and remembered for generations to come. If you'd like to learn more or find out how you can support their mission, visit GWATMemorialFoundation.org. Now let's get into today's episode. Hey, Aaron, welcome to the show. Really glad to have you here.
Scott, so great to talk to you again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, speaking of that, talking to you again, you had me on your podcast a few weeks ago, and it was a really great conversation. I'm looking forward to kind of picking up the conversation here. But for the listeners who maybe haven't caught that episode or maybe don't know a ton about you and who you are, can you just give us a little rundown about your background, your time in the Army, and all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah, I grew up in the Midwest, Akron, Ohio, kind of the burbs, and one of those guys that had enough natural talent and ability to kind of get by on without having to work hard or do a whole lot of effort. Mm-hmm. Until, of course, you get to college and then everybody knew how to work passed me by really fast. I call myself the old American slacker. So, finding myself after three semesters with nothing to show for it and booted out of college, I joined the Navy. And it was one of those things where it was going to be 4 years out, get that tuition money I just pissed away back and with the GI Bill, go become a chef. And that's what I wanted to be that week. I would get the college money, go to culinary school, become a chef. And during the maximum 4 years, I would do the OJT thing, on-the-job training. I'd be a cook in the Navy. That's sure. Mostly because I'd like those commercials, let the adventure begin type of thing right. When I was growing up. And I didn't want to carry a rifle in the middle of a jungle or desert or anything. And knew nothing about the Air Force, so it kind of cut out all the other branches. I would literally went in completely uninformed. I just walked into the Navy recruiter's office and said, "I want to be a cook." He's right. I took that ASVAB aptitude test. And like, "Do you sure we're giving bonuses for nuke tech on a submarine?" I'm like, "I saw K-19. No, thank you. I want to be a chef." I had no misconceptions about what I'd be doing, like cooking mashed potatoes in a vat the size of a Volkswagen on board a carrier, but might as well practice what I was going to be doing for the rest of my life. So I joined the Navy, got top of my class in cooking school, which is, it's like being the smartest. Never mind.
I think all the listeners who have experienced military cuisine, let's put it that way, probably are laughing along with you.
Anyways, I got my pick of the orders for the class, and I got shore duty in Naples, Italy. Only they didn't tell me at that time, like going through the school, that Navy cooks don't cook on shore duty, just on the ships. So I get off the plane and I arrive in Italy. I'm like, "Where am I going to be cooking?" They said, "Oh, no. We're more like hotel restaurant management equivalent from the civilian side. And our version of the hotel is the barracks." And because you're the FNG, you get to do the night clerk, like the night desk watch, handing out lost keys and taking in trouble call tickets. Super. But one of the first things I learned in the military was that I was going to get responsibility thrust upon me. And just the rank and position and responsibility, it happens so much faster than I felt ready for. And I just have to fill those chevrons the best I could. Mm-hmm. And within a couple very, very fast years, I was cooking for a 3-star admiral, the commander of the 6th Fleet in Gaeta, Italy. So I spent my first 4 years in the Navy in Italy. Hardship duty, it was not. But I went from the night desk watch at the BEQ to cooking for dignitaries and royalty and float around the Mediterranean making real food for the top brass. It was pretty amazing.
That is pretty cool. And especially being the new guy, getting a position there in Italy, that doesn't sound like a terrible place to be stationed. You know, I'm sure there's worse places in the Navy that you could have been stationed, right?
Nothing. That was amazing. I mean, yeah. Because I love travel and I love food. And I mean, one of my first Italian friends I made when I got there, he says, "Congratulations!" I'm like, for what? You're in Italy. We have the best cars, the best motorcycle, the best women, the best coffee, the best food, the best architecture, the best history. I'm like, that sounds pretty arrogant, and I'm an American. But 4 years later, I get back to the United States. They're like, so how was it? I'm like, they have the best cars, the best food, the best coffee.
Yeah, and you got to experience all of that, which sounds like a pretty damn good deal. So let's fast forward a little bit, kind of in your time in, and you had to experience some challenges, let's just say, you know, during your service. Tell us a little bit about that and kind of what took place there.
Well, as I progressed in my career, I became responsible, not just it was one of those things, the maturity and growth, and I went from the selfish needs. I needed to be a better me. I had those internal values, work ethic, the sense of pride and accomplishment, looking towards the future, having goals, having some, all that internal values. And I gained that. But along the way, I accidentally picked up those external values, like teamwork, sense of duty, selfless service, and pride in being a part of something far bigger than just me. And that was a lot more fulfilling than just the internal values. Mm-hmm. And I enlisted in 99, peacetime.
Sure.
And 2 years later, we're at war. Mm-hmm. By the time I was on board the USS LaSalle cooking for the admiral, we were in two wars. Yeah. And even though everybody's got that job to do, every role is important, and I believe that. Mm-hmm. I also believe that my natural talents and abilities and the skills and values that I'd picked up, that all of that was being underutilized by the military, by the Navy, and I felt I could be a greater asset to the warfighting effort. So I volunteered to deploy. I went to Afghanistan. I went from cooking for the admiral and his top staff to cooking for 300, 400, 500, 600 NATO troops, ISAF, in Farai, Afghanistan. It was me, another Navy cook, and 9 local national Afghan cooks all running this DFAC. And that's when I met some EOD techs, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, the military's bomb squad. And everything about that you know, the tight-knit brotherhood, the technical, challenging aspect of the job, and the fact that they're first responders on the battlefield, everything just clicked, and that's everything said this was what I was meant to do. So I put in my request in the Navy to strike or switch over from culinary specialist to EOD, and they promptly denied me. I guess my quiche was too important to the Navy. So when that first deployment was up, I came back to the States, and my contract was coming to an end.
Okay.
So I knew this is what I needed to be, and I loved being a sailor. I saw it in my veins. I loved being out to sea. And I still, you know, think aye and ahoy type stuff, but I had to do everything I could to become an EOD tech. So I let my contract expire. I went over to the Army recruiter and I said, I want to be EOD. They looked at my record and said, welcome, we need you. And they did. It was very busy. This was about 2007, 2008. And yeah. We were busy. So yeah. I became an EOD tech, changed uniforms, I got to keep my rank, but instead of petty officer, I became sergeant.
Excellent. So, and I was actually wondering how that transfer from Navy to Army would have taken place, and, you know, how, you know, would rank transfer over, would, you know, prior, you know, experience matter when it crossed branches? And I guess, you know, in this case it did. And so tell us about your time as a EOD guy, you know, what did that entail, and kind of how did that lead you through the rest of your career?
The transition from sailor to soldier, it was more like just being, you know, I was like a pretender, right? Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is I didn't have to go through the basic training for the army. I went to this like gentleman's course. You know, it was all the technical part, none of the dogma, kind of initiation type thing. So I felt like I was still a sailor, just in a weird uniform. But then I got to EOD training, and that's when. I feel like I went from Navy cook to EOD, mm-hmm. and. That was a year worth of training to become an explosives technician, a bomb tech, and it was amazing. It was difficult. It took a test on average every 2 to 3 days.
Oh wow!
And the attrition rate is huge, and it's physically demanding, but it's far more mentally demanding because there's so much to know, mm-hmm. and even after. You go through a year worth of really intense training. They tell you that's how you learn how to be an EOD tech. Because then you really get your training once you get to your unit. And the pace was pretty high tempo. We were always training. If we weren't deployed or getting ready for deployment or spinning, you know, doing a post-deployment, spinning up, spinning down, we also do stateside response. So there are very few police departments in the United States that actually have bomb squads. Mm-hmm. So when a local, you know, township or municipality has something like that, they call the closest military base. And so we would do things like old cannonballs that got dug up, or marine flares that just wash ashore, or that souvenir grandpa brought back from the Pacific.
Right.
Yeah. Anyways, and we also support the U.S. Secret Service. Wherever a protectee goes, they take bomb squad with them.
Okay.
So you went in 2010 when President Obama went to Indonesia to visit his old, you know, elementary school, give a speech at the Jakarta University. I was there. I cleared that amphitheater.
Okay.
When President Carter went to church, I cleared his church for him. Wow. And sat outside in those sweaty, hot Alabama, Georgia, you know, summer heat, you know, swatting flies and checking purses for any little explosives before they go in. Anyways, mm-hmm. we were always doing something.
Well, and it sounds like the work, like you were saying, when you go through the initial training for the EOD, you learn how to learn, because I would imagine over time, enemies' tactics and materials that they're using and different things would probably evolve. So if you just rely on just that initial training, and that's all that you go off of, eventually things are going to start to evolve and change and stuff. And that training becomes, I don't want to say outdated, but it's not as complete as it could be had you not kept up with it over time. And so yeah, you know, continuing the training and all the stuff that you do, you know, on the day-to-day while not being deployed is probably just as important as the initial training too, right?
Well, there was something that I mentioned earlier in the Navy where I'd learned that the Navy was always kind of force-feeding me responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I kind of learned to get used to not remaining, not being complacent. One of the things I used to do, I would reach a certain level and plateau. Like, mm-hmm. all right, I achieved it. I made it. Now I can sit back. I got that license, or I got, you know, that rank, and now I can be that. I can get comfortable here. But the truth is, what was it, Ray Kroc once said, you know, you're either green and you're growing, or you're brown and you're dying. Mm. He was talking about business, but it's true. If you're not constantly moving, looking for the next thing, and you're sitting back with your feet up, that's, you're not staying still. You're actually backsliding. Mm-hmm. It happens faster than you know it. And the EOD and the Army, it was true. And we were, every time we took one of those tests, if I passed, it was like, okay, next. There was no chance to plateau. We were constantly training, constantly getting better. You achieve one thing, and yeah, that doesn't mean you don't kind of sit back, take a breather, congratulate yourself. You'll celebrate the achievement, but you don't dwell there. And sure. That kind of mindset really helped me later on.
So going into, you know, all these different situations, these places that you had to go, you know, clear them, make sure, you know, for dignitaries and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, even, you know, being on deployments, you know, you're on your toes quite a bit. Like, it's a pretty intense environment, I would imagine, being the guy who's responsible for making sure that, you know, the stage doesn't blow up that somebody's about to walk on. Or, like, to me anyways, that would be like a pretty huge responsibility. I would think that, you know, putting that on any one person or even a group of people, that's kind of a big deal. You know, how did that stress kind of work with you? Did you use that? Like, some people use that kind of stress as like fuel, like that keeps them motivated, or did that kind of like eat you up a little bit?
It's certainly a motivator to know that you have other people's lives in your hands. Mm-hmm. And I'm the guy that goes ahead, clears the path, and then goes back and tells the rest of the support, you know, the unit I'm supporting, okay, I've cleared the way. It says it's safe from all known hazards, and you may, you know, you could proceed with a mission. If I don't do my job to the best of my ability, somebody definitely, you know, can get injured, die. And yeah, it doesn't put, you know, it puts a pretty fine point on to it. In fact, the motto for EOD is initial success or total failure. Hmm. That's not just about our own procedures and, you know, what could happen to us. That's about what could happen to others. If I don't succeed, the whole mission could fail. And mission failure could mean, you know, the difference between life and death.
Yeah, and I've heard other folks who were, you know, EOD guys that, who They were asked, like, how do you remain so calm under all this immense pressure to get this job right? Like you said, either it's a success or it's a failure, and you know, everything. And, you know, how do you stay calm and be able to handle all of this? And they said, well, look, it's pretty simple. Either I'm right and everything goes according to plan, or I'm wrong and it's all of a sudden somebody else's problem. And that's just kind of the mindset that they had, was like, look, I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. Not that I want it to become somebody else's problem, but, you know, like, it's going to be what it's going to be. And you know, so I'm going to do it to the best of my ability and kind of take it from there.
Yeah. How does the team drive the ball down the field at the Super Bowl of all games? Right. Blocking and tackling. From day one, we're taught safeties. You know, all the ways a piece of ordnance or an IED can kill us, mm-hmm. right? You know, what can set this thing off? What do we recognize about this munition that makes it function? How can we accidentally, inadvertently make it function as designed or another way and endanger ourselves or others? So we learn safeties. We learn to recognize that. Safety, mm-hmm. safety, safety. In fact, when one tech doesn't say goodbye to another tech, we say, stay safe.
Okay.
All right, man, stay safe. I'll see you later. And it's absolutely true. So when I say blocking and tackling, it's about the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
We learn, like, day one, it's safeties, and then it's the basic physics. We literally have classes on physics and basic electronics, circuitry, and we build upon those foundational, you know, building blocks to specifics of the ordnance, and then we practice and we train constantly. So that's when it comes down, when we get to the Super Bowl, that, you know, we're still, you know, just blocking and tackling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even like you said, even the Super Bowl, the professional athletes who are performing at that elite level, they rely on the basics. You know, whether it's the Super Bowl or the World Series or, you know, whatever it is, this is a football. This is, you know, this is a baseball. That it gets as basic as that. And you have to, you know, be able to do all the basic things that, you know, the young kids who are just starting off have to learn how to do. You have to be able to do all those things plus all that other stuff. And so, you know, the basics are super important. So, you know, to your point, you know, when it comes down to, you know, your Super Bowl of, you know, clearing whether it's an IED or some other explosive device, like, the basics, like, you got to rely on those and you can't ignore those and get cocky or whatever. You know, you have to look at it like, hey, yeah, this thing could really, really ruined my day, you know?
What was Grover's book, Relentless, From Good to Great to Unstoppable?
Okay.
He talked about Kobe Bryant. And immediately after an actual game, he would go to the gym.
Mm-hmm.
And he would practice.
Okay.
And because maybe it was something, he made a mistake on the court, mm-hmm. and he wanted to figure out how he made the mistake. But often he was just there throwing thousands of free throws or from a certain position, you know, a soft spot, a blind spot on the court he needed to get stronger at. And he would just throw the ball into the hoop, mm-hmm. over and over and over again until it just became muscle memory.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what you do in a game. It wouldn't have to think about it. It would just be the right action.
Right, and I think that's the best kind of training that you could do is when that stuff becomes muscle memory, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, shooting free throws or you know, defusing a bomb. You know, if you just have that muscle memory, that way your mind is freed up for other things, and that way you can do the things that you're supposed to do, and then, you know, use that freed up capacity to focus on other variables that, you know, maybe are showing up in a unique situation, right? Now, so your time as a EOD tech. Tell us about kind of how all of that kind of came to an end, and you know, kind of how you transitioned out of the military. What kind of took place with all that, and how did that transition look for you?
Well, the transition from sailor to soldier wasn't actually a transition, like I said, but
sure.
My transition from cook to EOD tech was nearly complete. I still love being a cook, mm-hmm. but it was like fulfilling my destiny to become an EOD tech. I loved going to work. I loved doing the job. I loved being of service to a fellow the war fighters, to our allies, being that cog in the effort to the maximum I felt of my ability, and I was constantly trying to improve. In my downtime, when on deployment, I also it was kind of funny. On my last deployment, when I was injured, I was there for 8 months. Still a cook, a chef at heart. And built a mud brick pizza oven. Well, some guys were playing video games and goofing off in their downtime, because you got to have your downtime. Mm-hmm. I was out back of our hooch making mud sunbaked bricks and put them together. I even wrote King Arthur flour, and they sent out a pizza stone and this awesome stuff. It was pretty cool. Anyways, it was an enjoyable time. It was hard, mm-hmm. but that also felt good, because I was being physical. I was challenging myself mentally, emotionally, and becoming stronger and more resilient. And frankly, it was like I'd finally found or created my purpose. And I think that's one of the biggest things to resilience, is that we need to, purpose isn't something you find like in a Where's Waldo book. it's something you create.
Sure.
And sometimes, who is it? Doc G, Jordan Grumet, has written a couple really great books. His most recent is called The Purpose Code. He talks about purpose being, everybody talks about purpose being the big P purpose, like that, destiny stuff. But mm-hmm. but sometimes it could be little P purpose, just something to do, something that's fulfilling in the moment, and maybe that turns in your big P purpose.
Sure.
But we need, we need to occupy ourselves. We need to serve others. And sometimes that's by becoming excellent at what we love to do. Sometimes it's just becoming pretty good at something we should be doing to be of service. But mm-hmm. in the end, it's being of service to others is what makes a human, and contributing to the community. So that's what I felt like. I was being a maximum service to my human community.
Yeah. And you had mentioned, an injury in this last deployment. And so could you tell us a little bit about that injury and kind of like what took place there, and then how that kind of affected the rest of your career?
Yeah. Well, I deployed once to Afghanistan as mm-hmm. a cook, then deployed to Iraq. And then in 2011, I was on my third deployment, second time to Afghanistan. First time as an EOD team leader. That's the guy that actually gets into the bomb suit and makes the long walk.
Okay.
The green space suit down towards some unknown or known device. But 2 months into a 12-month deployment, one of them had my name on it. I was working on an IED. I did not have the bomb suit on. The robot had taken that apart, so there was no reason to be in the bomb suit. I was just collecting evidence, so I had an evidence kit, metal detector, and I was making my way back down towards the IED to collect that evidence, when a secondary device had found me.
Hmm.
So it detonated, punted me into the air, took my eyes, cracked my skull, so I was leaking spinal fluid right out my sinuses. I was leaking spinal fluid right out my nose, but with everything else going on, that didn't even register. It just rung my bell, something good, and turned my lights out. I was kind of in and out for the next 48 hours, but I'd just come back from 2 weeks of R&R back in stateside. I got to see my firstborn turn one. I got to witness the whole family gathered around for Thanksgiving feast. And it was, I just call it the best last page in the photo album in my head that you could possibly have. It was an absolute gift that I'm so grateful for. Mm-hmm. And then I was literally coming. I was on my way. It was one of those, travel, worldwide travel to a battlefield that takes days, sometimes weeks.
Yep.
But I was 2 weeks from, the United States, coming back towards my area of operation. But I was still, I had the luggage in the back of my team truck, and we'd jumped a supply convoy out to our, area of operation when we got this ID call. So I hadn't even gotten back to our tent to unpack, and I was heading right back to the United States.
Wow.
Sitting at Walter Reed, both of my eyes were destroyed. Hmm. Skull busted. It was a lot to go through, a lot to the process. And you realize very quickly that if you have total blindness, you also get a sleep disorder. Oh, your circadian rhythm doesn't reset with the sunlight. So it's kind of like living on a 26-hour clock.
Oh, wow.
So I'd be sitting wide awake, like it was the middle of the day, but it was the middle of the night, with just my thoughts. Why me? What if I can't do this anymore? Yeah, my life is over. And it's very sad, depressing, frustrating, angry, place to be. Mm-hmm. Very lonely. I have a great family. They supported me.
That's great.
I also, there's warriors up and down the halls they were fighting their own fight, right? Mm-hmm. They had their own personal battles. And I realized that I'm not the only one here. I might feel lonely, but I have no monopoly on pain. who was I supposed to say that mine was a good enough excuse to quit, right? Mm-hmm. And I went through all the stages of grief. It was actually pretty textbook, almost embarrassed to say. It was very statistically accurate, but I went through them and came out the other end realizing that I've still got a role to play. I'm still the father, husband, soldier. Mm-hmm. I call myself a Narmy soldier, but I'm responsible to the Army. I'm still active duty, technically. And I'm still a soldier. I'm still a D-Tech, wounded warrior. I don't like using that term. I prefer, recalibrated carnivore or re-engineered expert.
Sure.
But I have these hats, these roles. I'm responsible two and four others. Mm-hmm. So after I was done, crying, done mourning the loss of my eyes, it was time to get back to work. And I kind of turned, shut the demons in my mind, that self-talk, the what ifs, the why me's, I just turned it off. And I started, instead of saying, I can't, I said, how can I? I started asking myself, how do I do this? How do I function without the loss, without my eyes?
Mm-hmm.
I cheated. I started looking for other people that were doing it and just follow them. I started, as soon as I learned how to use, you know, the phone with accessibility features, the text to speech software, I was on the online looking for, you know, searching blind plus this, blind plus that. How do you do this? How's somebody else done it before? I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. There's lots of blind people out there. And I found Eric Weinmayer, the first blind person to climb Mount Everest. I found that guy. I went mountain climbing with him. Lonnie Bedwell, another Navy guy, first blind person to kayak the entire Grand Canyon. Well, I found him. Guess what? I went kayaking with him. So I just kept finding these people who were doing amazing things despite not even watching what they were doing. And I joined them. I learned from them. And I ended up in the Florida Panhandle on the Gulf Coast. It's really hard to find decent mountains to train on.
Sure.
I started running. You know, just to get in shape because, man, they feed you like you're going through buds at Walter Reed. I mean, my lunch, dinner tray, they look like, you know, Belushi's in Animal House, you know, he's going through the cabin. I don't know why, but man, I was eating well. So I'd gained a couple pounds and I didn't want to carry all that up the mountain. So I started running, learned how to be, you know, run with a sighted guide. And eventually I was running marathons. And then it was the Boston Marathon. And then I was doing okay. I started speaking, telling my story. I started teaching at the EOA school. And, you know, 4 years later, I was well on my way to figuring out this whole blind thing. But it was like, yeah, destiny, fate, God, whatever. Maybe I was getting a little complacent. And it didn't sound like it, but I was getting kind of comfortable in my situation, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe plateauing a little bit. Or maybe feeling a little too much pride in my accomplishment. And, you know, I say God, he's got like that soldier's sardonic sense of humor. Kind of, he's like a prankster too, just like me. And he's like, oh yeah, you get a little bit, you know, big for your britches, buddy. Try it again. Here, try this. Yeah, you think you can do it? And I contracted bacterial meningitis.
Oof.
That crack in my skull. They'd been patched up, but I guess not completely. I had a small leak for 4 years right down my sinuses, and a path out is a path in. And bacteria went in and made it its home and started multiplying in my brain. And it was like acid being poured directly in and being stirred around. It was one morning, I woke up and it was so excruciating. It's actually a little embarrassing. I called 911. I said, I have a really bad headache. the operator said, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is the pain? I said, ma'am, I've never felt a pain like this in my life, and I've literally been blown up before. And she said, the ambulance is on its way. 4 days later, I was kind of in this like weird, where I wasn't very lucid or conscious, but I was scared and freaked out and I did confused. And the meningitis, I was fighting for my life. It was actually a closer to death kind of fight than the bomb blast itself.
Oh, wow.
And when I came out the other end, I fought off the bacteria, but it took what was left of my hearing that the bomb blast hadn't along with it. So I was left completely deaf. As well as completely blind. Oh, yeah, and that had a bonus give, just like the sleep disorder. It took my vestibular balance, that inner ear gyro.
Sure.
Not that I'm complaining or anything, but come on.
I think it's kind of a big deal, keeping that balance and not toppling over, especially if you can't really see what's going on. And, you know, that's
having to hold on to that, you know, the railing in the bathroom to keep from falling off the toilet.
You know, and so as I'm hearing you talking, I can see how somebody else in your same situation, going through all of these hardships and difficulties and everything, just being completely defeated and just saying, you know what, screw it. I this is it for me, and I'm not going to be able to do anything else with my life because of the circumstances of what's happened to me. But then I'm hearing this story from you and the stuff that you went through and the attitude that you had. You know, obviously, yeah, you're gonna go through that grieving stage initially. I think that's normal, and if you didn't, that might be a little bit weird, you know. But if you're gonna go through that stage, and then it's like, okay, well, how do I do these things that I want to do? And then you went and found inspiration. You found, call them mentors, if you will, other people who have been there. And you said you consider it cheating. I don't really think of it as cheating. I think of it as, you know, kind of being smart. Like, why reinvent the wheel if you don't have to? You know, there's other people out there who've gone through the same, you know, kind of situation, and they've figured things out. So yeah, learn from them. That makes a ton of sense to me. But you went and did all these things that other people wouldn't even consider. They wouldn't even, sometimes probably not even consider leaving their house. Never mind go climb a mountain or go kayaking or do all these other things that are difficult for someone with all of their senses. It's even more difficult for somebody without some of them. And you know, it makes it, to me anyways, like a kind of inspiring story that it's like, hey, yeah, this is a crappy situation. These things happen to me, but I'm not gonna let that define me and be the thing that keeps me down and everything. I'm gonna keep moving forward, and that to me is just like a, you know, obviously, like, hats off to you, because like without that kind of attitude, you know, you wouldn't feel the drive or the desire to do any of those kind of things. And it feels like, based on just the conversations that we've had, that, you know, continuing to serve people and support other folks is a big part of who you are, and service is a big thing. And that probably wouldn't have taken place if you didn't have that sort of attitude or mindset, right?
Well, a couple of things on that. For one, like I said, second time I had gone through the stages, textbook stages of grief, but it's a process. It's literally your mind, your heart, your body going through this process of change that you didn't really want, and you sometimes it's for the best, sometimes it's just what is, but it doesn't, you don't turn on a dime. So it's okay to feel angry, to be bitter. It's okay to feel those feelings. And but on the flip side, though, have you ever tried to extend, like, guys cry. I mean, I cry most of the time. It's when I stub my toe, which is all the time. But have you ever tried to cry more than you needed to?
No, I can't think of that. No, I mean, it's probably not a normal thing for most people to do, right?
Yeah. But the thing is, when you're done feeling the feeling, you got to move on. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, I came back home from the hospital the second time, and I'm there sitting at my breakfast bar, you know, the counter on a stool, holding on for dear life. But you know, I was angry. I was lonely. I was frustrated. I mean, I was trapped in my body.
Yeah.
No sight, no sound. My whole world ended at my fingertips. And when the COVID thing came through, and it all the quarantine, and everybody's talking about, like, you know, on TikTok, like, how frustrating it is. I'm like, welcome to my world, people. This is nothing. but seriously, I was angry. I was upset. And then one day, I was just bored, because I'd gotten through, you know, I'd processed that, and part of that was turning it around. You know, stop thinking about me. And that's, you know, one of those things about resilience and, you know, the military, you know, EOD techs, 3-person team.
Mm-hmm.
The given is like a tri-con, quad-con, full, you know, the partial shipping container full of tools. Everything that explodes, that's our wheelhouse. So there are specialized tools from everything from bullets to nuclear bombs. We've got some pretty intricate and specialized tools for things we'll never need, but we get them all just in case. But we get to the battlefield, and we get that armored truck that I talked about, and it's not nearly as big as the shipping container, so we got to do a little triage and leave some tools behind. We take what we're most likely going to need, and we drive on. Mission still has to continue, whatever tools we have. And then we got to Afghanistan, and we're on goat trails, dirt paths.
Right.
There's no roads in Afghanistan, so definitely not that can, you know, fit our massive trucks. So most of the time we were dismounted, we're on foot, and we could only bring the tools we can carry on our backs.
Yep.
Ended up being, you know, a few blocks of C4, some rope, carabiners, some knives, and then our standard battle rattle, you know, water, food, ammunition. And, you know, EOD techs are real big about knives. Got a couple different knives. Anyways, we still got to do the job, no matter what is ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And things being hard is never a good excuse for mission failure.
Right, right.
So I was there, I'd sitting at that counter, you know, kitchen. I had to leave a few tools behind. Now I got to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I have, you know, the people around me, the skills and the attitude that I've learned, my resourcefulness, my creativity, and I had to drive on, right?
Yeah.
I had to continue the mission. So it went from I can't do this to how can I? And then I modified it to how can I so that I can teach others? Because I don't know where I heard this. It's stuck in my head. It's tattooed to the inside of my brain. But I heard someday the story of your struggle may be the blueprint for someone else's survival.
Yeah.
So I need to learn the best I can so I can present it to the next person that might be going through their own personal struggle. And I got to be able to teach them the best I can. And you know as well as I do, in the military, half our jobs are teaching our successors.
Right. That's right.
We teach a lot. We give trainings. We teach people to replace us because, you know, we want to be promoted, right? But mm-hmm. what if, you know, on the you know, darker side, what if we fall?
Yeah.
We need somebody to fill in. And that's the way I look at it. I want to teach others so that they can succeed too.
Yeah. And I mean, your attitude about all of this is just, to me, first off, it's inspiring. It's really a great attitude to have. Like I said before, I can definitely see how someone would go the other way though, you know, because they're just defeated and it's just a struggle for them and they're, you know, having all sorts of issues with that. But, you know, your attitude is like, no, we're going to make this happen. You know, yeah, sure. Like you said, maybe you got to leave a couple tools behind, but still you have a mission, you're still a father. You still have, you know, people who rely on you and need you for certain things. And okay, well, gotta get
it done. There's always, you know, two sides to that coin, right?
Yeah, sure.
There's that victim mentality.
Yeah.
And then there's that winner mentality, right? Mm-hmm. There's excuses versus reasons.
Right.
And I could have used it all as an excuse and I just thrown up my hands and like, all right, I quit. This is too much.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know who it was, but they're talking about, can you have courage without vulnerability?
Hmm.
And what is courage? That's the ability to stick your neck out for something more important than the potential to get your head lopped off.
Yeah, right.
That's what is more vulnerable than being courage, having courage.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I had to have the courage to try.
Sure.
I had to have the courage to figure it out and get off my butt, get off that stool. And frankly, I was terrified. I was not just terrified. The thing was, I was terrified of what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I was more terrified of, well, what would happen if I didn't try? If I got stuck sitting on the couch, feeling sorry for myself for what would inevitably be a much shorter life.
Yeah, right.
So that fear is what drove me to seek out mentors, to seek out, you know, peers, mm-hmm. and to get the heck out of the house, and, you know, find, you know, friends to socialize, to get out there and try harder.
Yeah. And it seems like you're doing, you know, such a great job at it. You know, I'm just hearing your story and everything that you are doing is just, you're moving in the right direction, right? And we briefly talked about your podcast at the very beginning of this episode. I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the podcast and tell people what it's all about and, you know, kind of how, you know, some of these lessons might tie in and some of the stories and other discussions that you have on the podcast, you know, can help other listeners kind of, you know, take away some valuable lessons.
Absolutely. Well, since I have a really hard time reading notes, so, or, you know, a teleprompter, it's hard for me to do monologue type episodes, though I try.
Sure.
I use a podcast platform, the Point of Impact with Aaron Hale, to share other people's incredible stories. Because, well, with, you know, as a podcaster, with a, you know, you got this platform, people gravitate to that so they can tell their stories, and you get to have these incredible conversations one-on-one with people that probably wouldn't even answer the phone if you didn't.
Right.
So I get to talk to some amazing individuals, and they're doing awesome stuff, and I get to learn from them. At the same time, I get to do that whole teaching thing I love, mm-hmm. but I'm not really doing the teaching. I'm just being a facilitator.
Sure.
So it's fun. It's engaging. It's entertaining, educational, and it's something to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's important too. Having something to do to keep busy. Like you said, when you were deployed building that, you know, that mud brick, you know, pizza oven there, like, it was something to do. Some people found video games, some people found other things to do to keep themselves busy, but yeah, you need something to do. Keep you going. And, you know, why not have conversations with folks like yourself and, you know, other folks that I've had on this show who have inspiring stories and different perspectives that maybe mm-hmm. maybe I wouldn't have thought of on my own. And then I start talking to someone, it's like, hey, you know what? That guy might be onto something, and let me dig into that a little bit more. And, you know, that type of thing helps, you know, me anyways, as a host of a show, helps me to kind of put certain things into perspective. I mean, I've never been in your shoes. I haven't, you know, lost all, you know, sight and hearing and stuff. I do have some hearing loss, but not to the same extent. But, you know, hearing where you came through and the motivation that you had to keep going is something that, you know, for me, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I might be the type of person who would struggle with that type of thing. Not to say that you didn't struggle, but where I don't know that I would have ended up on the same path, same trajectory. But then hearing stories like that, I'm like, you know what? Man.
I struggle all the time. I mean, yeah, you should have been recording that whole thing before with the microphone and before the show started. Oh my gosh. 101 ways I can mess something up.
Yeah,
blind deaf guy trying to do a podcast. But
figured it out.
I'm a stay-at-home dad with three young boys.
Right.
And,
right.
I mean, I get to have real adult conversations right here at home.
Uh-huh.
I get to learn. I get to share with my boys. You wouldn't believe who I got to talk to today. And it's extremely fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of the Point of Impact is that, you know, the audience, the listener, and myself, I get to become that potential me. I get to be better so that I can give my best. Be my best so I can give my best. And it's like it comes full circle so that you can contribute the best you can mm-hmm. to your community.
And that's, you know, I think that's all anyone can ever ask of you is, you know, just provide the best you can. Do your best. Do what you can. And, you know, just just keep moving forward. And you know, it's really great that you are putting out this show with all the different guests and stories and things like that you have. You know, again, it's really inspiring and insightful conversations that you have on there. And you know, it helps build a community or you know, connection to other folks as well, which I think is really important for people, especially veterans who like to, you know, sometimes just isolate from other folks. And you know, it, you know, kind of just shows those connections are available, they're out there to be made, and you know, all those things I think are really important. But you know, I did want to give you that opportunity to talk about the show, because I want to encourage folks to go check it out and listen to it, because you know, there's a lot of great stories and conversations that are had on there, and I think folks can definitely take some good information away from it. So, but Aaron, I want to thank you, you know, for coming on the show. Really great having you here. It's always been, you know, great conversations whenever, you know, we get to chat. And, you know, yeah, barring any technical difficulties, which for the listeners, you know, what Aaron was referring to is before we started recording, where it's just some technical issues with the microphones and stuff. And it was just hard to select the right microphone on his end, but we figured it out. He figured it out. You know, he was able to just keep pushing forward and you know, trying different things until something worked, and then it did, and here we are. And I think everything sounded great, and we're all good to go as far as that goes. But you know, but it's because of that same attitude. You know, like, hey, I got a job to do here. I'm gonna just keep pushing forward until I get it done. And you know, here we are, and we were able to have that conversation. You know, and everyone is able to hear you, you know, crystal clear, and you know, everything is great. So thank you for, you know, first off, for pushing through on the technical difficulties, but also for, you know, coming on and sharing your story. I know that story is not probably the easiest one to share, but you know, once when your story gets out there, like you said, it could become that blueprint for somebody else to, you know, start their healing journey. And you know, hopefully that's somebody who's out there listening today, and they get that message across to them, and they start moving in the right direction. So thank you again, Aaron, for coming on the show.
Well, I really appreciate having on. It was great to turn the microphone around, because I got to talk to awesome guests like you, Scott. Yeah. And I appreciate your patience, as even though I'm being a guest on your show, I couldn't figure out how to unmute myself. Yeah, we got to figure it out. And I appreciate the invite. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much.